Welcome to another episode of the Nui Tech People podcast. On today's episode, we have Adam Boyle, former CEO of Pegasus. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks, mate. Thank you.
Mate, one of Newcastle's biggest tech success stories, both Pegasus as a whole and your career to date. But, mate, for those of our audience that don't know who Adam Boyle is and the story of Pegasus, mate, love to give a bit of an overview of who you are and we'll dig into that.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me to start with. This has been a little while coming, I think. We've been talking about it for a little while, but I'm still uncomfortable in this space. You know, we've kind of, for most people that, you know, knew of Pegasus and especially at the time that we started to become, a little more known in town, you know, we slipped under the radar for a long time and I was comfortable there, I think. So me having to come out and tell the story afterwards was a challenge for me personally, but it's also put me into a spot where, I've had to experience a couple of new things now, which is good. So, but we were a 35-year-old company here in the Hunter Valley, you know, and that's probably the funny part of it all is everyone thought we were a bit of an overnight success, but the company had been around for a long time.
Yeah.
I hadn't been there the whole time, you know, but at a point in time, we were a labour hire company who got into training. You know, we had our own registered training organisation and the place was operating well, you know, in Singleton, out of an old school in Singleton for a number of years prior to any of the big labour hire companies coming to town, you know, and these guys probably had no, you know, inkling that they were going to ever turn into a tech company and were just, you know, continuing to employ mostly truck drivers on mine sites in the end. And, you know, at that time, lots of people wanted to go and try driving trucks in the mines. And so I remember one of the funny stories was when I first got started in the CEO role, had all of these people who were hitting me on Facebook. I had, you know, I was like my most popular on socials because everyone wanted to get a job driving in the mines. And so, you know, I didn't anticipate that was going to be the start of it all.
Yeah.
My background had been in technology and I came to Pegasus from one of our competitors, Peter Eason, who was the original owner of Pegasus, and Steve Newman had brought me in.
Yeah.
And both of them said to me at one point in time, you know, we've pretty much copied what you guys did over at SGS, which was the company that I was working at the time. And SGS was a larger certification company, probably least known for this sort of thing, most known for a lot of the certification inspection type work that they did. And so it wasn't kind of core business. And my move to Pegasus was more about, you know, exploring this a little more than what, you know, SGS were going to let me. But also, you know, these guys seemed really interested in growing it and seeing where it went to. And so I jumped there in about, I'd spent 10 years, I think, at SGS at that time, moved to Pegasus, who were located in Singleton, in about, I think that was 2007.
Yeah.
And then that's how it started. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's quite an interesting story as well, because I think a lot of people in the tech space is like, you have to be an app, you have to be code first from the beginning, yeah. Right? Whereas, especially in the Hunter Valley, a lot of the tech success stories locally actually have come from more traditional businesses that have maybe scratched their own itch or built something for themselves, which has then evolved from there.
Most definitely.
How did the Pegasus tech story evolve for you?
Great explanation of it. And it's something that's hard to explain to people now because it's sort of, you know, everybody thinks they have to come in and find a new idea now. And it's such a struggle to try and find something that's new because of probably the depth of the, you know, this market now, the tech market now, would be a lot harder. I would find it hard to kind of find a new business these days. But for us, it was basically on the back of a great services business and, you know, a good reputation around town, being able to then focus on doing something a little more electronic than what it was before, you know. And that was our first approach, was that at the time, everybody was doing safety inductions in mines. You know, and it had become a thing. Legislation had moved in a path that meant that everybody had to start paying respect to the fact that everybody coming on their mine site at the time needed to be inducted safely, so they understood the risks involved in the work they were about to do. And our company was, through our RTO, was mostly doing that sort of training for mine sites and bringing people on. And so our movement into the digital space was to say, you know, we think we can do this a little better, you know, and what if we start capturing some information on the people, and what if we give them a card at the end of it so that you know every time they turn up here that they've done it, you know, and how often are you going to redo this induction? So it was all answering those simple questions to start with and building some technology that allowed us to do that, which then expanded into you know, worlds that we didn't ever anticipate at the start. But we, you know, we listened, we stayed kind of nimble at the time to you know, go after a few different opportunities, and some things just kind of led to the next opportunity. And the great story about Pegasus, and one that I like to tell, is that, you know, Newcastle is so fantastic a place because you've got such great access to the coal front, you know, and it's not only, you know, the mine sites. We've got you know, a rail network that runs through here to the biggest, you know, black coal port in the world, you know, and then you've got all the other things, all the surrounding ecosystem here that allows us to be able to set up a great business and have a really good testing ground for that to get going. And that's what we had here. You know, we just listened to those guys. And then over time, we were able to diversify a little bit out of mining and into something different.
Yeah.
And that's when it all started.
Yeah. Oh, mate, I really like that. Yeah. I really like the story of that, and leaning into, I guess, the hunter's strengths, yeah, and leaning into the advantages we do have here. Like, I love software. Like, I love, you know, technology is, you know, the game I play in. But Newcastle's never going to be the software hub of Australia. It's never going to be the place where, you know, the biggest apps and the greatest apps are all built from the scrap, and we've got thousands of people investing in it here and building that team. The hunter's advantage is leaning into the advantages that we've got here that other places don't, and then building upon that. As yep. you said, you've built a software business on the back of scratching your own itch, with your own self being customer number one.
Definitely. Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, it's kind of the secret sauce of being here. You
yeah.
know, and people who have done it well, you know, have worked that out early. And then I guess after that, you then have to try and find a way to diversify, you know, and get out of here a little bit.
Yeah.
So our second big, or our next biggest customer outside of mining became Woolworths.
Yeah.
Woolies, we tendered for a piece of work that we didn't originally win. They awarded it to someone else, someone much smaller than us, who weren't able to service the contract. And what they worked out about this, you know, this model was that not only did you have to be able to have, you know, decent software that solved a problem and great ideas and innovation, all that sort of stuff, but you needed to be able to back it with some service. You know, you needed to be, ours was bringing on contractors, onboarding contractors, and eventually pre-qualifying. And once you started to get into the scale of it, you needed to be able to keep up with the scale of the, you know, customer support and success stuff as well, which Pegasus was at the time big enough to do.
Yeah.
And they eventually got us to come back in and have another look at it once that existing contract had sort of fallen over a bit. And so we spent a bit of time in there saying how we would do it. They awarded it to us eventually, and then it took a much different path. You know, then you're talking about coal mines who typically had safety and training teams and lots of resources and a decent sized budget for something like this, to retail who doesn't have a budget. You know, they have one or two safety people across the whole of, you know, Woolworths.
That's amazing.
And it was crazy, yeah. So we had to go in a much more lean approach to how we had to try and, you know, look at how we would structure pricing and you know, be much lighter on the way that we onboarded contractors and the time that we spent with the customer and all of that sort of thing. So we started to build out these portals, which eventually became our, you know, the thing that we were known for. So we built something that the contractor could do themselves and largely get all the way to the end before we had to verify it. You know, there was this kind of trust thing at the end that needed somebody to verify what they'd uploaded,
yep,
or, you know, the training that they'd done or whatever we were asking them to do. And that became, you know, Pegasus's role in the Woolworths contract. And so we'd gone from this really heavy hands-on, heavy touch with the mining guys trying to justify the high price that we were already charging them to this really light approach with Woolworths. And then why that turned out to be significant was that a point in time, you know, when there was downturns in the mining areas and mining regions and stuff like that, we were then asked to do more of what Woolies was doing.
Yeah.
So we were kind of ahead of the game at that time. Yeah.
I love it. Again, if you look at a lot of startups, right, they come in there with, I've got this 5-year plan. Right?
Yeah.
I've got a business plan, how I'm going to go about it. And,
yeah,
you know, a lot of early stage people coming in there, giving some advice, is like, you've got to have a plan. Who's your target market? La, la, la,
yeah,
la.
Yeah.
Whereas it seems like some of your success actually come from being able to pivot quickly and being a little bit opportunistic,
yep,
and so seeing where an opportunity is and then moving and running quickly with,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You're
keen to understand you're sort of like, yeah, that.
And I think also tapping into a network of networks that already existed, you know, and that you didn't have to recreate. You just had to help them penetrate and find.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you get there first, you know, you're at an advantage, because if you, what we used to, our sales approach at the time after we were successful with Woolworths and then trying to sort of capitalize on the mining clients that we had, but also then move into other areas. And, you know, we won a major contract with Rail in a program that we called Rail Industry Worker that still to the day, this day is, you know, in existence and probably like no other sector in the country has a single way of managing contractors, you know, through a single card that, you know, is accepted across all of the whole rail network. And for us, it was about being able to get after that network of networks quickly. So we would go and get the beachhead clients to start with. You know, we had targets of going after number, you know, 1 to 5 quickly. And if we could get 3 of them, then it was easy to sort of get some of the rest, because you, once you start building the network, you know, the new clients would come in and say, oh, so, yeah, how many contractors are already in your system that work in construction, for example? And
yeah.
So we've already got, you know, Lendlease, and we've got John Holland, and we've got these others. And they'd say, so we'll give you a list and you can tell us how many there. And if we could say any more than 50%, you know, it's kind of, you didn't have to do much more to sell. But that was the dream. You know, if you could get there, then and the quicker that you could get there, then, you know, the easier it was to keep the ball or to keep momentum rolling.
So know? Going after those big ones to start with, and that gives you, I guess, the proof, right?
Yeah, for sure. But you had to start somewhere. And I think from a startup wild goals, you know, that is the dream for most of them, is to try and land the big client, you know, that gives you the story to then keep going, especially in our space. It is absolutely the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
Building the tech, it's difficult as well, especially if you're not at the cutting edge just yet. You know, you've got to try and find your way there through having these relationships with clients. You kind of want to hear how they talk about it so that you know that you're solving the problem for them. But getting that first sale over the line is the hardest. And then trying to move into other, you know, other areas and other regions, I mean, that's just as hard over time, but it's very strategic. And it is absolutely the most fun part as well.
Yeah.
You know, when you're not there anymore, it's the single thing that you miss the most.
Oh, yeah. Mate, so it sounds like for the vast majority of it, like your customers actually drove your software. So you were building on the back of, you know, customer feedback and what do they want, and then you can flip out a new feature and continue to evolve like that.
Yeah, and we didn't always get it right. Like I talked about that Rail Industry Worker program.
Yeah.
You know, as the story goes, and we eventually, you know, decided, because at the time we were bootstrapped up until 2019. And by bootstrapped, I mean we actually had a, you know, I told this story to our Excel KKR committee when we were first pitching for the money. We'd flown around for 12 months, you know, been to London probably 3 or 4 times. We'd been back to the US probably 6 times every couple of months. And we were, myself and our chairman at the time, Craig Jones, who was sort of instrumental in our exit in the end, had flown around and told the story to a lot of people. And, you know, Craig kept trying to refine what I was doing. Like, he was pretty critical at the start. He was like, you know, don't say that. Like, you just, they won't be coming back to us because you just said that, like this sort of thing, which was okay, because we'd worked out, you know, we needed to tell the story as much as we can to get to the end and find the 2 or 3 that we knew that were strategic that were going to invest in us. And so we did that. We got all the way to the end. You know, we had 2. We'd flown into San Fran after being there a few times before, and we knew what we had to do, and we're going to meet the investment committee. And I had this deck, you know, I'd worked on it for ages, and I'd not slept, I reckon, for 2 days, you know, and even on the flight on the way over, I'm just going through it, make sure I didn't stuff it up, and I didn't open it. So we got into this investment committee, and they'd already seen everything they needed to see, and I didn't open my laptop. And I'm like, the CEO at the time, he said to me, or he's still there, he said to me, tell us your story. You know, we haven't met many Australians. Tell us where you come from. And so we started to talk about that. And he said, so, you know, we were talking about the bootstrap story. How have you done this? And we sort of said, well, at the time, I convinced, you know, we convinced Peter Eason and Steve Newman, who were the original owners, to not take any dividends for a period of time. And eventually Phil Stalker, who was my CFO and my business partner, who was as big a part of the success as I was. You know, I got to sit out the front and tell the story. Phil was at the back office, you know, doing all the hard stuff and making it happen. But we'd convince them not to take any dividends for a long period of time and use the good cash that we were getting out of the employment business and the training business just to fund the development of this software that was eventually going to take over our business and be, you know, the livelihood of the thing. And they trusted us enough to do that, you know, and there's a lot of trust that goes into that because these guys got nothing out of it for a long period of time until we kind of got to a spot where, you know, we were able to transact, you know, and it became, you know, valuable to everybody at the time. But, you know, it was a long way, you know, yeah. It's a lot of trust and you got to continue to tell the story and you got to continue to, you know, ride through the ups and downs.
Especially the last couple of years, right, in the VC market. Yep. I think the last couple of years in the VC market has really shown some instabilities and it's gone from a time where everyone money was very easily accessible for a long time.
Yep.
And it wasn't even about turning a profit or even sometimes not even making any revenues. It was just about customer acquisition.
Yep.
Money was easy to come by and then the market changed.
Yep. No, I've definitely seen that in the last few years. I would hate to be having to ask for money now the way that we did. And ours was a, you know, kind of a series of opportunities. You know, we put ourselves in the right spot. I always say that we were lucky. We were lucky because we were in the right spot at the right time. People knew of us. But Craig Jones, who had come in as our chair, had got in touch with us because he'd seen our logo on a few other transactions. You know, we were showing up on the M&A pages of people's pitch decks, you know, and he said, oh, I think you've got something. You've obviously made enough noise and you've got a big enough market share that you're important here in Australia. And so these people are saying, you know, after you give us the money, we're going to go and have a crack at Pegasus. So he said, let's try and build it so you're ready, you know. And so we did that with him. We got through the first sort of raise. We had Tom Abravo, who wanted to buy the whole thing. We had Excel KKR, who were happy to go on a minority raise and see where it went to after that. We ended up going with Excel because we thought we had a bit of growth still left in us and we'd like to see where we could get to in the next sort of 3 to 5 years.
Yep.
So on Christmas Eve on 2019, we signed the deal with Axel KKR for a Series A at, I think, $28 million, I think we raised, at a maybe $58 million valuation.
Yeah.
And at the time thought, you know, the world's our oyster, you know, we do what we want to do now. We've had no cash leading up to here. We've just sort of scraped by all the time. We had 3 or 4 different versions of we're not going to make payroll next week, you know, and it got worse and worse as it went on because by the end we had 120 staff and you're thinking, you know, this is the worst thing that can happen in business because you've got all these people are relying on you.
Yeah.
And I've made a bad decision and now we can't make payroll, but we found our way through it. You know, my wife, Jo, was our chief of sales and there was 2 occasions where she landed and got clients to prepay, you know, that actually kept us alive, you know, and not many people would hear those stories.
No,
you know?
Matt, people only to see the glamour story sale and the successful acquisition.
Yeah. Yep. So that, you know, those things there, when you think back and think how it all came around, the kind of the resilience and the durability of the place and people wanting to just get after it, you know, to do whatever it needed. You know, it was kind of built on the back of that. And so by the time we got to the end, we had a bit of cash. We thought, yeah, now we can go and do some cool stuff. Yeah. And then a month later, COVID came.
Oh, mate.
You know, and we couldn't go anywhere.
Mate, we'll come back to the COVID bit in a minute. I've just made a note, a couple of parts I want to come back to. The raising part.
Mm.
Just before we get too far away from that, obviously you bootstrapped for a long period of time. I know now you've got a successful exit. You've spoken to quite a few startups, done some mentoring in around that space.
Yeah.
Mate, what's your current position? Obviously the market's challenging at the moment, but what's your current advice piece for, you know, any of the startups that you're working with or advised around? How early did you take on money? Yeah. Obviously if you can self-fund for a period of time or use some of the revenues to actually drive further enhancements, it can be beneficial, but at a point in time, it is super valuable to take on that cash and continue really that upward curve. What's your current position or advice around
it's
that?
It's changed a little bit. Like selfishly, I used to say, hang on to it as long as you can.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you get to the end and you've got a small cap table and, you know, you've bootstrapped most of the way, you're very attractive to VCs and PE guys. You know, they really love that story because you don't have to convince many people that, you know, the next phase is the right phase. But also, you know, you've got reasonable expectations.
Yeah.
You know, you're not investors who have got maybe they thought it was going to be bigger than what it is. And so, you know, you're having to go back and reset expectations, or in some cases you have to go and do a down round, you know, to raise more money. Like all those things are difficult conversations that if you've only got 3 founders or 3 shareholders in the end, they seem much easier than what they They are, and you've got a bit of propensity for a lot more risk probably, because you know your own boundaries and you know where you can push. So I used to say that, but now I'm involved in the other side of it, and it's so hard to, as a startup, to get started, you know. And I said to somebody last week, I could go and ask five of my mates, you know, to give me $1 million, and they would, because they know I've got a background and they know I've got a bit of experience here and a track record. But for somebody who hasn't done it before, they got no chance sometimes, you know. And so it is really, really difficult. And I now see the need for people to be able to, you know, to raise money and do that and to keep it going. And, you know, but still, you know, you've got to have that in the back of the mind. When you get to the end, you've got to be doing it because it means something to you. And it definitely means more if you own more of it.
Yeah.
I've said that to most of the companies that I've been working with. And at the moment, you know, it's not only good enough to have recurring revenue and, you know, a good growth percentage anymore. You need to have EBITDA, you need to have size, and you need to have, you know, got started along a lot further than, you know, where we were giving money to back in 2021. And so it is difficult. You know, I feel for people who are trying to get started at the moment, because especially can you look back at companies like Pegasus and you think, I want to do what they did, you know, but we were in the right place at the right time. We were definitely in the right place at the right time.
You mentioned that twice, and we'll dig into that in one sec. But the other part you mentioned just there, obviously it means a lot more if you own a bigger percentage. You also mentioned just before about not being able to make payroll or being close to not being able to make payroll. Obviously, they're super challenging times, right? Everything looks great now after a successful acquisition, but those challenging times, personally for you, like how did you get through that? Because I think a lot of people look at stuff, it's shiny and bright, and the upside is fantastic, right? Like it's like no other in business if you have that success, but there's a lot of challenging times along the way. Like how did you personally deal with that?
You know, you have to have that in you to start with. Like, you know, I've probably never shied away too much from any of these types of challenges before. So you got to be, you know, you got to personally be a bit resilient. And I had my personal life hadn't, you know, it had some bumpy roads up until that point in time. You know, my ex-wife and I had split up when the kids were young, you know, and so I was having to juggle spending time with the kids as well. And then, you know, trying to run this business that was growing quickly and required me to be in it a lot. I tell a story now that it kind of worked to my advantage a little bit, because I, in the times that I wasn't with them, I was keen to go and travel and get away and not, you know, be thinking about something else mostly, you know. But when I was here, I tried to be present with the kids, and that part was hard. But, you know, the best part about it was that the people that helped me the most through that were my Pegasus, obviously my family, but my Pegasus friends as well.
Yeah.
You know, and they accepted the fact that I wanted to spend time with my kids, and they wouldn't bother me then.
Yeah.
But also they were in it with me. You know, I had people like Jake Mullins, who was my CTO, Prue Killick, who was our head of people and culture. You know, my brother, who was the chief customer officer, Joe, my wife now, and, you know, a series of other people like Ben Satchel and Brooke Cronin, Brooke Ferner now. And I could probably name another 10, 15 people who are now lifelong friends, you know, and we went through some tough times together, you know, but every time it happened, I knew they had my back.
Yeah.
And same as them, if they ever had a challenge, you know, we'd do it together. And so the thing that I've tried to say to mostly these the startup companies now is that you need to find other people that you can rely on. You know, I didn't mention Phil Stalker there. You know, one of my best mates, you know, who was my CFO at the time and business partner. We had a discussion at one point. Phil used to come in to me and say, on Friday afternoons, I'm worried about next week. And I'd say to him, mate, what do you think I'm going to do now? I said, don't come in here and tell me we're not going to make payroll next week on a Friday afternoon, right? That's a new rule.
Yeah.
Tell me on Monday. We'll solve it then.
But otherwise, your weekend's done.
Yeah. Weekend's done. So we laugh about that now, but we had so many of those conversations, and you just found ways to get through it, and you brought people in, and you all together, you found ways to get through it. You know, we were all in by the end. You know, we had every cent that we had, you know, in the business. I was still renting. You know, Phil had, you know, worked hard to have you know, some investment properties that were, you know, basically all on the, you know, listed on our business at some point in time, you know, as backing for what we, you know, for what we had to borrow from the bank.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to bring people along.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to believe. You know, you have to believe. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that thing is just as you said, the belief, like knowing that you got that big picture in mind going there. It sounds like the network's probably the biggest thing. So yeah, for anyone else that's going through it, it's making sure you surround yourself with the right people.
Yeah,
making sure
you got this. You have to be able to give them something, whether it's responsibility or reward them. When we eventually were acquired by Avetta, every one of our staff had got something out of it, and some of it came from my personal money and Craig's personal money, and because we wanted to reward everybody. But we had, 10 people who probably nearly got $1 million, who'd stayed there for a long time, were loyal servants of the company. And when you think about the opportunity for a Newcastle tech company to do something like that, where people get to pay off mortgages and, buy investment properties and stuff like that, like it's, that's the dream, isn't it? So
100%.
Yeah, I really like that part in the end. I felt like, all those people who had stuck with us over time got rewarded when they had to, yeah.
Yeah, mate, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. Mate, the other part you mentioned, you've mentioned it a couple of times, right place, right time. You mentioned the word luck before, which I think, you can luck into things, luck out of things, but, net, longer term, I think, the success is on the back of a lot of good things along the way, right? Mate, that right place, right time thing.
Yeah.
You're telling the story up until COVID. Mm. Mate, what's that story from COVID onwards?
Yeah, so from COVID onwards, the plan for the 28 million was to go and expand outside of Australia. We had still 99% of our revenue was coming from Australia. And to sort of get the next, if you build up the multiples, in our space, we knew if you were growing, you'd get attention. If it was mostly recurring, it'd step the multiple up a little bit. Then if you were global, if you were outside of Australia, the percentage went up again. If you're making money, and you had decent EBITDA, then you're looking at strong models. We ended up trading at nearly 8.5 times revenue.
Yeah, beautiful.
Because we had some of those things in place. The thing we didn't have was anything outside of Australia. So we thought we'll try and get there, and then after we've gone at, probably four times, which was where we took the Series A.
Yeah.
We'll try and get to 8 by growth outside of here. And so we were ready to just jump on a plane, start getting over and get some boots on the ground over in the US and the UK. And then all of a sudden COVID came and no chance, and you've just taken money from a PE guys who were expecting growth. And we knew we had sort of 3 to 5 years to get to where we needed to. So it wasn't panic stations, but we were still trying to find ways to grow outside of Australia. Funnily enough, we were probably spending more time talking about strategy than we ever had.
Yeah.
Because you just, you had time to yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that's what COVID did, was it sort of gave you a little bit of time back that when you're potentially in an office and, in those times you'd go and grab lunch with people or you'd go and sit around and have a...
That and travel, right? Like you're not traveling anymore. Yep. So a lot more time at home, as you said.
Yeah. So we decided, let's try and find some partnerships. Like let's try and find some partners over that kind of were closely aligned to what we did, and we could maybe explore some opportunities there. And we'd already gone and met through the 12 months before when we were trying to raise some money. We actually went and met all of our competitors in the US and the UK, which was interesting, because the most of them knew of us. We were trying to give them some insights as to where we were heading. We were confident that we were a little way ahead, being in this market, and especially around the worker side of our competency management component. And so, we went in there with strategically thinking, this is our next one. We're still trying to land this first one, but actually we're setting up the second one as well. So that's something that I say to everybody now. Whenever you're raising money, it's important to get the raise done, but you need to be thinking about what the next one looks like, Otherwise this one doesn't make sense. You might not be taking enough money. You might not be positioning it well for the next one. So definitely, being able to have the next raise in mind helped for us. So, we went off on this path of then going back and reintroducing ourselves to these guys that we'd already met, who already knew enough about us to be interested. But we went straight to Avetta and we said, are you still interested? We want to try and get a bit more traction in the US market. We know you don't really have a worker product. They'd started, but they hadn't made very good headway in that space. Would you be interested in a partnership? And they said, yeah, well, let's explore it. So about a month into it, I get a call back from Ashad, who's the CEO, you know, who wasn't involved in the conversations to this point. We were just sort of talking to Scott Spencer, who was the, you know, sort of head of growth, and he really liked the business to start with. He was the one that sort of introduced us all the way through. And I do owe a lot to Scott. He did, you know, he was a lot of the reason that we ended up in the room with Avetta. But Ashad said to me, look, we aren't really interested in a partnership. I thought, oh no, we, you know, there goes that. Like, we've spent a bit of time on this. He goes, we want to buy it. And I said, well, I don't know how that can happen. Like, we're a year into this strategy with XL KKR. They're expecting a 3-5 return. You know, we wouldn't even be up around one yet. You know, we're growing still. And that was the great thing about COVID, was that in COVID, people needed software like ours. Yeah. You know, trying to get people back to work. So having compliant software, we were already using card readers and stuff like that to get people on site. So all of a sudden that was more, you know, we put the thermal scanners on the top of the readers so you could check to see whether anyone had a temperature. It was things like that that you kind of pivoted to do quickly.
Yep.
But largely, you know, the 80% of the core was stuff that people needed right now. And if people got their, you know, the right training, the COVID training that we were doing, have they been immunized? All that stuff we already held in our databases for other reasons. You know, like Coldwood Medicals, for example, were the equivalent of the immunization, and we were capturing that many inductions that, you know, another COVID induction wasn't much.
Yeah.
So it just we sold well even in COVID.
It sounds like, again, no, that's another version of you pivoting really quickly, yeah, and on the fly. And I tell you, that seems to have been like,
yeah,
a little bit of commonality.
It definitely did, success. But we didn't move too far away from the core. I think that was the other thing. We always focused on what we were good at and building that network out still. But we were upfront with him. He said, look, let us have a look. Share with us the data room that you've just put together. And at the very least, we might come back and say no, you know. So we were happy to do that. It was getting towards Christmas. This is sort of, you know, October, November. And on the day before Christmas, which was like the year prior, we you know, signed all the agreements on the day before Christmas. He rings me back the day before Christmas the next year and says, oh, we've got to a number. I think you'll like it. You know, what do we need to do? And I said, well, tell me what the number is first and I'll tell you what we need to do. And he said, well, you know, our PE guys think that it's worth about 100, but we're willing to offer 110. You know, and I said to him, this is, you know, the exact conversation, because I remember it exactly. You know, I've always thought if someone came and offered me $100 million for a business that I built, I'd fall off the chair and, you know, you'd have to get me back up again for me to say, yes, thank you, and, you know, really appreciate it. But it's not going to be enough, you know. And he goes, don't you need to go back and ask the others? And I said, I just know the expectation already. I'll do it, but if I do it, it's probably final, you know. So I'm just telling you now, just so that we can talk through what the strategy might be. And he said, well, let us have another look at it. And I said, but what have you got to look at? Like, this, we can't.
You've already had a look.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, well, we're probably going to have to do it on future numbers. So we're going to have to lock into, you know, what you think is the future here and do it, you know, based on what the forwards look like. And I could tell he had something in mind. You know, I could tell that there was a reason that wasn't spelled out to everybody at the time, which, as it turned out, was that, you know, they'd kind of not made some promises, but they'd indicated to some of their biggest clients that they'd have a product like ours soon, you know, and one of them was Amazon, you know, one of them's Rio Tinto, one of them's Cargill, you know, and so it kind of made sense to be investing in that space for them to move that forward a little quicker than probably what they expected. So I could sense that was going on in the background, but, you know, we just played it out. They eventually got to the number.
Yeah,
you know, so he came back to me on the 14th of January. I'd spent most of January, like, you know, with a feeling sick, you know.
Yeah, I bet you.
I've just let the biggest opportunity of our lives go. But yeah, he came back and hit the number and went back to Excel and said, you know, I know it's not ideal. You know, you guys probably wanted to be here longer, and I wanted them to be there longer. I'd had such a good time with them because they were. They had an like a consultancy side of the business that, as a tech company out of Newcastle, you don't get that. Like, yeah, you know, well, I went to a summit before, a CEO summit before COVID came, and they had 40, 50 other CEOs there from companies similar size to ours who were all growing, you know, and you sat down and said, oh, how did you do this? And they're all just so willing to share.
Yeah.
You know, and I got more out of that 2 days being there than I'd ever got out of, because there wasn't a scaling software, you know, ecosystem here in Newcastle at the time, you know. And so I wanted to stay in longer, but the opportunity was there. You know, we'd already had the discussion about what an exit looked like. you know, as I said, Craig and I had been planning for the next one, and we got to the next one 3 years before we thought we did. And so it kind of, that was it. That was the story. Yeah. Nice.
Matt, it's super impressive. And it's great for a Newcastle success story to have that as well. That part you just mentioned about the summit, I think it's a good thing. It's a point for Newcastle. It's a point for everyone, but in particular Newcastle, because we can be, you know, a little bit siloed away from any of the major cities, in particular Sydney. If you don't have access to that mentorship before that, did you have other people that you would lean on through that journey that, hey, maybe you'd gone through a similar path before or had some successes that you could lean on during that?
Yeah, for sure. And the way I like to learn is through my relationships, you know, and I definitely had a lot of those relationships. You know, I gravitated towards people. You know, it probably started off with my dad.
Yeah.
Dad's a financial advisor, but, you know, he was the guy that I looked to as far as, like, we used to have this saying at Pegasus that I don't want you to play work. Like, let's stop playing work. Like, let's not pretend. And they said, and people said, why do you call it play work? And I said, because when I was younger, I used to get dad's old computer and sit there in my room and pretend I was being dad, you know. And so that was me playing work, but I don't want you to do that sort of thing. So, it started off with dad. Prior to working at SGS, had worked at Newcastle Basketball and Maitland Basketball, and dad was at Maitland Basketball at the time. He'd gone to Maitland Basketball to try and get the stadium built up there, and so he'd taken a bit of a hiatus from his financial planning career and gone and done that. And the state, we've got a nice four court stadium now. And
how good's that?
Yeah, all on the back of mostly what he did at the time. I went and worked for Phil Matthews here at Newcastle, who I still to this day we meet and have coffees and talk about life. Completely different, but he gave me, I think Phil said to me at one point in time when I first started, when you're starting a new role or if you're doing any new job, make an impact to start with. And I kept that in the back of my mind every time I did something, like, you know, go hard early, you know, let everybody know that you're serious and get the numbers on your side to start with, so you've got a bit of a track record. So I've always remembered that. Dave Fleming, who was at the university for a long time, became my first boss at SGS.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the people that I met at Pegasus, Peter Easton and Steve Newman, were great fellas, you know, and I didn't get to work with them as long as I could have, but they introduced that kind of family culture that we continued on with. Phil Stalker, you know, one of the smartest guys I've ever met, you know, and understood me, you know, and put up with me, I think, you know, and I'll always be grateful for him, you know, to him for that. And then, you know, all the other people that I got to meet along the way, and finishing up with Craig Jones, who, you know, Craig and I, we clicked straight away, you know, and he was the reason that we finished where we finished, you know, and got to the exit.
Mate, I think that's super important. I've heard it from other people as well, from that networking perspective, surround yourself with the right people. Sounds like you surround yourself with the right people, the right places. You picked up little pieces from people along the way.
Yep.
For others that are earlier on in their journey than where you obviously got to, any advice for picking out those mentors or seeking them out?
Yeah, I think I always started with, you know, whether or not I'd, you know, I like them as a person.
Yeah.
You know, that's the most important thing. I think people leave that to the end sometimes. They try and find, you know, smart people and people who have got a background or, you know, some experience in a certain area. But I always thought if I can get on a plane with them and fly to London, you know, and have a good conversation, you know, one of my best friends is Hiran Patel, who is one of the main guys that took a job with, I think he came to us through you guys, you know, and an Englishman who, you know, a gentleman who came into the place with eyes wide open and ended up being, he used to call himself the JVP because he was going to take over from me at a point in time. But he's built a network now that I watch him go over and spread his wings over. He's in Texas working for Avetta. He's seeing the world and, you know, just great people that you like to see do well afterwards. And also, you know, people that you didn't mind sharing it with along the way. All those things are important. You know, if you kind of think that in the back of your mind, eventually this is going to get to a point in time where we're all going to have to agree on this.
Yeah.
You know, and if we don't stand for the right things, you know, if we've got different ideas on how the world should work and different, you know, morals and values, then it's probably not going to work out. So that was the first place. You know, after that, I always found people that did the things that I didn't like doing as well, you know.
I like that.
And I really admired them for that. Like, it wasn't, there was nobody in our room who thought they were the smartest. you know, and they all, everyone had appreciation for what other people did. You know, some of it took a while to, like our finance people took a while to warm to the sales guys, you know, because they're all telling different stories all the time. And, yeah. But we got, like, when we were at our peak, you know, and really enjoying it and doing particularly well, you know, we all enjoyed each other's company as much, you know, so that's as important a part of it as, you know.
I think, mate, that enjoyment of the journey, right? Like, you spend so many hours at work, and as you said, you know, some of your best mates now have come through that experience.
Yep.
You spend so much time there. If that end goal is just a dollar figure, it's going to be hard to fight through the bad times. It's going to be hard to fight through the, you know, the challenging days, challenging weeks, or even just the time and, you know, who you're spending it with.
No, you're exactly right. And we didn't have a dollar figure. We never had a dollar. We knew that we wanted to get the number of workers in our system up to a point in time. And it was all about the chase. Like, we loved winning those big accounts. You know, everybody enjoyed it. Like, we were all a part of getting it to start with, just based on the way our sales process would work. But in the end, we'd all enjoy it as well. And then you get on with the next one. Like, it was like, what's next? And I remembered a time when we won the Lendlease contract, you know, and we'd worked on this for 12 months, you know, and we knew we had that. They'd said we'd been awarded it, you know, and so we'd done so many presentations, and, you know, we'd pitched a few times. We'd had to go and meet all the different various parts of the business and resell it again. And then we went through the contract process, which took forever. And then I didn't hear from them for a little while. And I thought, I was driving home from Sydney one day, that we were just trying to execute the contract. So it was already done. I rang them and said, oh, how's the contract going? Oh, yeah, no, it's signed. Do you want to come pick it up? And it was like that. I was like, you know, obviously means more to us than it does to you. But I went in and just, like, I was about to go over the bridge and came back and went into Barangaroo and picked up the contract and then drove home. And on the way back, I rang Joe and I said, hey, guess what? I just got that Lendlease contract. And so he goes, oh, cool, I'll tell everyone, you know. So by the time I got back, you know, we're in King Street.
Yeah.
And we've got a little gate that comes into near the old waterboard building there. And so I pushed the thing, and our whole staff were standing in the driveway.
Yeah.
And I'm coming through with this, you know, holding this contract out the window, waving it like this. And everyone's like, and then we went over to the Happy Wombat and, you know, had beers all afternoon. And but that's, you know, when you're done, you don't remember the money.
Nah.
Like, you don't remember that. They're the things that are the best stories, you know, and that's the reason you do it.
I'll dig into that for 1 second before we get into what you're working on now. Mate, you mentioned the word family a little bit before, and the work culture feeling a little like that. A couple of your colleagues have become your best mates, obviously, the whole team getting behind it there. Any advice for other companies in trying to build culture?
Yeah, I didn't realise it at the time, I think. And one of my good mates is Josh Doolan from Mudbath as well. Yeah. You know, and Josh did a lot of work for us in the early days when we were trying to build our team. You know, we weren't able to get there quickly enough. He was one of the ones that built those portals for us initially that helped us get some really good traction in that market. We kind of had to build our own team after. We got him in to do some supplementary stuff for a while. And then we sort of lost contact for a couple of years because he was off building his business and we were going pretty strong after that. And then after we had transacted, I went back and said, oh, you know, let's catch up. Like, let's go through. And so I'd taken a couple of startup companies in to see him and said, you need to use Josh. Like, this is a good time for you to get in contact with him. And I watched him pitch his business. And he said to me, you're going to like this, but he said, I'll learn off Pegasus early on that it's okay to employ your friends. That if you can go and put out to the staff, you know, we're about to put a job up and you can bring one of your friends in and introduce them to the company, then there was this kind of expectation from both sides. I've got to bring in someone good, you know, because we have a kind of a no dickheads policy here.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not going to stand for me bringing in, I'll lose some credibility if I bring in someone silly. But on the other side of it, you know, you want people with similar value. You know, everyone knows what to expect here and who will get along with who. And so you're getting more people to make more decisions about how the company evolves than just the one person at the top who's just the, you know, the finger pointer saying this is how we're going to be.
Yeah.
And I had some, like, you know, Joe and Prue and Brooke and Ben and all those guys I've mentioned before, that they were the ones who led the culture. It wasn't me. Like, I kind of told them what my expectations were early and they just ran with it from there, you know, and they would find people that they thought I would like, you know, and that fit in with the culture. And that's when you know you're doing well. Like, it does become a family because, you know, when your kids start to bring in partners eventually, You know, they know the ones that are not going to get along with mum and dad. And
yeah, yeah.
So it's very similar to that, you know. And coming from a sporting background, and I used to like being the leader of the sporting teams as well, I always thought that was the best thing that I could do, was to try and build something that eventually grew. You know, I like having a big group of friends.
Yeah.
I like lots of my groups of friends interacting together and introducing them more. I don't have sort of different...
Yeah.
I just like having people together.
I like it.
And it's, you know, how I've done business as well. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Oh, mate, in the business part as well, like, it's significantly easier to do business with people you actually enjoy spending time with or enjoy doing business with.
Yeah.
Part of it's, you know, a financial aspect, but I feel like some of the best business relationships I've had have been with people that I get along with as well. Like,
yeah, and we've been, you know, we've been dealing with you guys for a lot for exactly the same reasons, you know, and there's other examples of that around Newcastle where you've kind of spread into other ecosystems as well. And, you know, I think I've known Linda for the whole time that we've been in business, and she's helped me. I remember sitting there telling that there was, you know, 15, 20 people of my key kind of people that she'd introduced to me because she knew
what you liked.
What we liked,
I think it's a key aspect, mate.
Yeah.
And then to today, mate, obviously you've had your nice successful exit. A guy like you's probably not going to sit on your hands for all too long. I know you've done a bit of consulting with other companies, but what's the big next plans?
No, it's good. I mean, the consulting thing didn't sit all that well with me. I thought it was always just a means to be able to find what was next.
Yeah.
I always thought if I just go and talk to enough people, I said to people, if you buy me a coffee, I'll come and have a chat. So I've had way too many coffees and I'm carrying the weight to show it at the moment. But yeah, eventually got involved with Craig Lambert from XT Ventures, who is in the sports and health space. And we invested in a company called Engage RM. And I started to spend a bit of time with him because I really liked the guys there. And I liked the story, and I thought the story sounded familiar.
Can you give us a quick overview of the story?
Yeah, sure. Now, they're a CRM who'd started in the professional sporting space. And a guy named Brett Yorgi had been the original founder of this business and had grown it, you know, and found something interesting enough that a lot of the AFL, NBL, NRL teams in Australia were using this to run, you know, to manage their ticketing and their partnerships and their sponsorships and, you know, their suites, all that kind of thing, and get, you know, great data out of it to be able to suggest things to the clients about how they might be able to sell. And, you know, when I first got involved, I thought, isn't it funny that nobody's hit this market yet? I thought Salesforce or, you know, one of those guys would have done this. But because it's so niche, you know, and because it's about using a CRM for a very specific reason, he'd built something that was very specific to those guys, and I liked, that's kind of what Pegasus was, you know. We'd started off with something that everyone thought, gee, it's not, you know, it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
But when it grows quickly and you get there first, you know, you can do really good things with it, you know. And so they're a Microsoft partner. Microsoft took them over to the US. Brett had decided at the time that he wasn't the right guy to lead it through the next phase, and so he brought in Ned Coton, who was an ex-Perth Wildcat and 6'10". Like, I feel like I was big at Pegasus, but this guy towers over. And so, you know, he's gone over to the US with Microsoft and signed the Clippers and the Lakers and,
how good,
you know, the Bucks and and I'm a massive NBA fan, so it sort of ticks a few boxes for me. But along the way, Ned said, you know, like, I don't have the tech background to take this further. We need to scale. We're not scaling particularly well. You know, would you like to get more involved? And I said, no, I'm not really interested in a job, but, you know, flattered that you're asking me. And he said, well, what would get you interested? And I said, oh, no, honestly, you can't pay me. Like, I don't want to be paid, you know. And he said, well, there's got to be something. I said, well, I think if I own part of it, that would be. And I think that's the luxury of being where I've ended up, you know, is that now I get to go and make a decision like this about who I can put money in, and I have to know that I can provide value to them.
Yeah.
And I have to know that even though it's all risky, there's less risk involved in, because I understand my own, you know, what I can bring to the table. And I can see all the things that I liked there about Pegasus, you know, all these great people there willing to go at it. They've probably not been paid enough to do what they've done.
Yeah.
They've got these wild dreams, you know, of having most of the professional sporting landscape and others, you know, and I've bought into the story. So,
beautiful.
Starting in May. Yeah.
Fantastic. Mate, I look forward to following that journey as well. As you said, mate, bringing a bunch of your skills and experiences and networks as well to that, and you knowing the value you can bring to that. And I think that's a nice spot to be, where you know you can come in and add value and take it to the next step.
Yeah, I've already got a couple of ex-Pegasus guys involved, and we'll probably have an office in Newcastle, I'd imagine,
beautiful,
at some point in time. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Fantastic, mate. Mate, appreciate you coming in, spending the time with us today and sharing your story. I love the Pegasus success story. I love the fact that something born and bred in Newcastle has, you know, gone on to international success and successful exit. So congratulations.
Thanks very much, mate. And, you know, thanks for your support over the time as well. We've really appreciated it. I don't do many of these, but I was more than happy to come in and have a chat.
All good, mate. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you.